And we're holding page Lamed Gimel in Ksubas, the paragraph Daf Nun Aleph from a Beis, middle of Osir Beis. A large part of the Perek talks about the responsibilities that a husband has to his wife. You have the three that are Min HaTorah that we learned about a few days ago, and then you have the various ones that are Banan. One of the ones that are Banan is that if she's captured by Goyim, then he has a responsibility to redeem her, to ransom her, basically, to pay money for her to get out of captivity. Now, what happens after that? Now, in some cases, she may be mutter to him. If he's Yisrael or a Levi, then she's mutter to him as long as there may be a concern, as discussed earlier in the Masechta, that they might have raped her. But if he's Yisrael or a Levi, that wouldn't matter. If he's a Kohen, she'd still be also to him. Nevertheless, he has a responsibility to ransom her, because after all, it's not her fault. And the fact that he's also to stay married to her, that's not her problem, basically. But then what happens if she did willingly submit to them? Then you have a problem, because then she's also to her husband regardless. So the Gemara brings Tana Rabbanan, Shvuye Malchus Harein Keshvuyin. Women who were captured by an official government are considered captives, meaning they remain mutter to their husbands. Again, assuming the husband is not a Kohen. Gnuve listus enim kishvuyim. On the other hand, if they were kidnapped by robbers, then they're not considered shvuyim, because then there's the possibility then that so Rashi learns that the problem is that if they were captured by listim, it may well be that they give in and they have relations with their captors willingly, and in that case, then they're also to their husbands, and therefore the husband doesn't necessarily have a responsibility to ransom her. That's according to Rashi. A lot of Rishonim have a problem with that explanation, because it comes out that you're saying basically that when it's listim, then there's a good chance that she actually gave in and submitted willingly. But what makes us say still that it was willingly? Fine, it's not a malchus, it's a listim. But why should we assume that? Why should we assume she gave in willingly in the first place? So the Ramban and other Rishonim bring an explanation from Aben Hanano that the vote is that with Listim it would be easy enough for her to scream out, and then people would come and rescue her. So if she didn't, then there's reason to think that it was willing, as opposed to with a Malchus, then realistically she's not going to be able to do that. And there's more about it. We'll talk about after when we get to the end of the paragraph. Then we'll talk more about the details, the ins and outs of this. Anyway, so the Gemara says, "Valtanya ipcha." We learn a brisa that says the other way around, that if they're captured by an official government, then they are not considered shvuyos, because then we consider that they may have gone along with it willingly. Whereas if they were captured by listim, then they're considered shvuyos, and their husbands have a responsibility to ransom them. So the answer is malchus a malchus like Kasha. The answer is there's no contradiction as far as governments. Haba malchus achashverosh, haba malchus ben netzer. Because it depends whether you're talking about the kingship of Ahasuerus, so a big official kingship. So Rashi explains then, look, I mean, she knows if, like in the times of Esther, realistically, what are her chances that he's going to actually marry her and take her as his queen? Very low. More likely, she's going to end up being, at best, one of his pilagshim and stuck over there in Beis HaNoshim Sheni, like you have over there in Megillas Esther. So therefore, to begin with, if she's captured, then we can assume that when she ends up having relations with him, we can assume it was Ba'onis. As opposed to Malchus ben Netzer. Now, who is ben Netzer? So Rashi describes he was a listim, he was a robber, and he captured a number of cities and became a king over them. So basically, like a warlord, like you have, nowadays, for example, you have in different parts of the world sometimes where people do a military coup, or they have a gang of people who eventually seize power, like you just had a couple of weeks ago in Syria or whatever. So that would be this ben Netzer was an example of that. Rav Shuda Gaon actually gives his full name, and his Igeres, which describes a good part of Jewish history in the times of the Amoraim, and then later, Rav Shuda mentions that there was a papa Bar Netzer who, he says, destroyed the city of Nahodah. Nahodah was a big Jewish city, it was the center of Jewish life in Bavel in the times of the Tanoim and early Amoraim. This papa Bar Netzer, so he captured and destroyed the city. Eventually it was rebuilt. We find later Chachamim who lived there, but it never regained its former preeminence. But the deal with him is like this. Historically, there was a kingdom located in what's now part of Syria. The capital is called Palmyra. You have major Roman ruins over there. It's an international, it would be a tourist site if it was safe to go there, basically. But whatever. Anyway, this fellow, or he's called in history Odenathus, had a kingdom over there. It's basically on the border between the Romans and the Persians. And at some point, he decided that basically the Persians and the Romans had been fighting each other for on and off for centuries. So this Papa Barnetzer / Odenathus decided that he's going to get into the act and he's going to go fight against Persia on behalf of Rome. So he invaded Persia, which included Babel at the time, and as we're saying, he destroyed the city of Nauda. But basically, the Gemara is saying over here, he may have had a kingdom, but he's basically just a warlord. He's not really a legitimate king. So therefore, he's called a listing.
It was Nero?
Nero? No, right. Who says that? No. Oh, I see. It was Nero. Interesting. I don't know where he got it. I have no idea where they get that from. There is an explanation from some of the Rishonim that say that Ben Netzer is Nebuchadnezzar, and we'll talk about that soon. But that anybody says it's Nero, I never heard of such a thing. Anyway, Achashverosh is a fully legitimate king. He rules over an actual empire, as opposed to this Ben Netzer. Papa Ben Netzer is basically just a warlord who got a little too big for his britches. So on the other hand, though, he is a king in a certain sense. He had coinage and all that, and therefore, but relative to Achashverosh, he can be called a listing. Listus, alistus, like Pasha, then there's no contradiction between the two braises as far as if the woman was taken prisoner by listim, by robbers, because like Pasha, hobe ben netzer, hobe listus to alma. Because you have ben netzer, this warlord, versus you have plain old robbers, the low class ones who don't actually rule over any territory. So the Gemara says, ben netzer, hosim kari le melech, hosim kari le listim. So what are you telling me? In one context, we're calling him a king, and in another context, we're calling him a robber. And the answer is Ain. Gabi Achashverosh listim. Who relative to Achashverosh, Ben Netzer is nothing more than a listim. He's nothing more than a robber who got a little too big. Gabi listim, the Alma Melechu, but relative to an average listim, relative to an actual robber chief, then yeah, this guy owns rules over a chunk of territory, so therefore relative to that he can be called a Melech. So again, Rashi explains then the idea would be like this. So again, if you're talking about if the woman was taken prisoner and brought to Achashverosh's palace, then we assume it was Ba'onis. Because realistically, she's going to realize what are her chances to become queen. Very little. So therefore, it's Ba'onis. On the other hand, with Ben Netzer, there was a possibility, given that, after all, he does rule over territory, and she may consider herself, you know what, I had a shot with him. So therefore, she may give in Berotzen, and then she's also to her husband. On the other hand, when you have a listim to Alma, when you have a plain old listim, then why should she bother hooking up with such a person? So therefore, again, we can assume that it's Oynes.
So you
saw
that the lady also?
So no, if it was Berotzen, she's also to her husband no matter what he is, yeah. If it was Oynes, then she's also to her husband only if he's a Kohen. So again, that's Rashi's explanation, but a lot of Rishonim have big problems with that. And Amban, for example, discusses that, among other things, then in that case, it comes out that Esther should be considered Berotzen, and we know she's, because after all, she did become queen, and we know she's a classic case of Oynes. Ad Kedekach, the Gemara tells us in Rosh Hashanah that whenever she had the chance, she would sneak out of the palace to be with Mordechai. And he goes on with that a little bit. The Ramban brings an explanation from Abin Hananel. What it is like this. Again, it's similar to Rashi, but for different reasons. The reason why, in the case of Achashverosh versus Ben Netzer versus the Listim, the vort is that if, for example, with Ben Netzer, because he's not so powerful, therefore, if she screams out, then people would be able to rescue her. So then the Ramban explains, and then the fact that she didn't, then we have reason to say that maybe it was Berotzen. So then the Ramban goes on to say, okay, so now, on the other hand, a plain old listim is, first of all, that she has more reason to be afraid of them, that they may kill her on the spot. After all, Ben Netzer, as much as he's a listim, a warlord, after all, he has a certain dignity, he considers himself a king, so therefore he's not just going to stand kill people willy-nilly. So that's another way of looking at it. Then now that Ramban brings like this, he brings from Gilyonei HaRishonim, from writings from earlier Rishonim than the Ramban. He says that who is Ben Netzer over here? Not this Papa Ben Netzer that we're talking about from the times of the Gemara. Rather, it refers back to Nebuchadnezzar. So Nebuchadnezzar, Ben Netzer. The idea being And the Medrash tells us like this. When Nebuchadnezzar had his army besiege and destroy, and then destroy Yerushalayim and destroy the Beis Mikdash and so forth, he gave them instructions as follows. He says, I know that the Jewish God hates immorality. So if we go and the soldiers all over, the armies often go and rape the women wherever they come. But he says, I know that if we do that to the married Jewish women, then Hashem is going to be angry at us, and we're going to end up, and it's going to be held against us, and we're going to end up losing, or at least not being as successful as we would otherwise be. So make sure, he says to his soldiers, keep your hands off the married Jewish women. The unmarried ones are fair game for you. So the Medrash mentions that many women then, even the ones who weren't married, made an effort to find any Jewish man who would be willing to marry them. There's a pasuk in Yeshaya that mentions that seven women will be grabbing a hold of one man, asking him at least marry us, and that would be the idea. In other words, at least if his name is on them, then at least they'll be safe from Nebuchadnezzar and his armies. So the Medrash ends up saying there were a couple of married women that did get raped. And I guess maybe the soldiers didn't realize they were married, or who knows what, whatever. And then there were a lot of basulis. Thus you have the pasuk in Eicha, Noshim Betzian Inu Basulis Ba'ara Yehuda. Anyway, the vote would be therefore. So if a woman tells them I'm married, then they'd leave her alone. So if she doesn't tell them and they end up violating her, well then we have reason to think that it was Barotzin, as opposed to with Achshverosh, when they're being taken to the palace, then she doesn't really have that option. So the vote would be, then in that case, why we call Nebuchadnezzar a listing? He's a legitimate king as well, because the point is, his soldiers are not, it's not like with Achshverosh where it's in peacetime where women are being gathered together by royal edicts. Here it's the soldiers are doing whatever they want. So therefore, relative to Ahasuerus, it can be called Listus. So several different explanations. Where they're getting the footnote over here, where they identified Ben Netzer as Nero, I have no idea. Next. The Gemara continues to talk about in the Perek. You have we know there's a concept. Anybody over here who's married off a child, and anybody who eventually will, as Hashem knows, that you have to eventually deal with your mechotanim as far as wedding arrangements and as far as nadin and all that sort of thing. So the Gemara tells a story that a papa was going to be making a shidduch, and he goes over to his mechotanim's house to talk about the terms of the nadin and all that. And to make a long story short, the Gemara mentions that there was one of the chachamim who a papa asked to come along with him, Yehuda bar Meremar, and Yehuda says, I don't want to because I think that if I don't want to. And so the Papa asks him, why not? Is it because you think that it's not right that they should be setting aside money for their daughter's Nadin because of what the line the Gemara is going to bring over here, because the Yerusha is supposed to go to the sons after all, and the Papa tells him after all, it's not so. I mean, a person is supposed to give a nice sized Nadin to his daughter. The Gemara goes on and tells the rest of the story. Eventually what happened, there was a misunderstanding, and the Mechotonim ended up giving a far larger Nadin than they were supposed to. But whatever. In the middle of the story, then, the Gemara says that this Yehuda bar Meremar quoted to Rapapa, or Rapapa actually quoted to Yehuda, the following statement. Amalei Shmuel Rav Yehuda, Shinina, sharp one, which is Shmuel's favorite nickname for Rav Yehuda, Loi Tevi Ba'avuri Achsanta, never get involved in transferring a Yerusha from one Yodish to another, Afilami Bora Bishal Bora Tova, even from a bad son to a good son. So you might have a person who thinks, you know what, my son, one or more of my children is a no good Nick, whatever way. Therefore, I'm going to disinherit him and give my Nachla to my other children. So Shmuel tells Rav Yehuda, don't get involved in such a thing, like, for example, to sit on a base din to deal with such a case or to be an aide for such a case. Because you never know what kind of children. Fine, it's a bad son. You never know. He might end up having good descendants, and you don't want to take it away from them. How much more so from a son to a daughter that you shouldn't be, where after all, the Torah says that the Nachla is supposed to go to the sons that it's supposed to go to the sons and not to the daughters. So Shmuel tells Rav Yehuda, don't get involved in trying to tamper with the dinim of the Torah like that. So therefore, Rav Papa says to Yehuda bar Meremar, so what do you think? You don't want to get involved in this in the negotiations because you think that that's what it amounts to, that we're taking away some of the Yerusha, some of the future Yerusha, and giving it to my Mechotanim's daughter, to my Mechotin's daughter. But the fact is that you're supposed to give a Nadin, and the Gemara goes on with the rest of the story. I forgot to mention, by the way, yesterday we had a thing related to that at the last piece of the Gemara, was when you have Bonim Levanech of Shalom al Yisrael, and the Gemara had brought that there's Shalom al Dayoni Yisrael, because they won't come to argue. So we talked about a couple of possibilities. How does that mean? When there are children and grandchildren, then there won't be fights over the Nachla, and therefore the Dayanim will be at peace. So Marsha says it's somewhat related to this. When a person has only sons, he may think, as we're saying over here, that look, you know, some of these sons may be no goodniks, and maybe his grandchildren will be no goodniks or whatever, and therefore he may think to write out a document giving away his nachla to somebody else, which can cause friction then between the children and those other people and so forth. When he has children and grandchildren, then already he realizes that it's much more likely that eventually he's going to have descendants from all his children who are going to be good and who deserve to have his Yerusha. Therefore, he won't be writing out such wills and documents like that to override the dinim of inheritance that are in the Torah, and therefore there'll be Shalom al Yisrael among the Dayanim, because the Dayanim won't have to get involved in disputes like that. Afal pi perek chamishi, so the perek begins by talking about the dinim of ksuba, that even though you have a basic afal pi, even though you have a basic amount of a ksuba, a husband can add as much as he wants, which we call tosfos ksuba. In our standard ksubas nowadays, we have that. There's the basic 100 for a non-basula and 200 for a basula, and then you have in the standard text of the ksuba, tzvi, reb ploini chosin dinam, the chosin agreed on his own, and he's added X amount as tosfos ksuba, and then we summarize the whole thing and so forth. Anyway, so then further on in the perek, it talks about, now in the previous perek, it talked about the responsibilities of the husband towards his wife. In our perek, it talks about the responsibilities that the wife has towards her husband. She has to do various kinds of housework around the house. So the Mishnah says, Ve'eva melochas tra isra oisa labayla, the following are the tasks, the household chores that a wife has to do for her husband. Techenes v'chola, she has to grind the grain, which the Gemara explains what that means exactly. Millstones in those times weren't always something that a person could handle. So it means she has to supervise it, basically, and several other things the Mishnah mentions, and Umenikas Bernabachola, and another one it mentions is to nurse their child. Meaning, in other words, that if she's not obligated to nurse children that he has from a previous marriage or from another wife. But in other words, the point is that she can't say, you know what, I don't want to nurse the baby, I want you to hire a wet nurse, unless, as the Mishnah goes on to say, if they have maid servants or whatever, then it's different. So you have those seven things that the Mishnah mentions, the Yerushalmi mentions, and then there are more basic things like serving the food and other such things like that. Well, the Gemara says, Masnisim de loike Reb Chiya. Our Mishnah does not hold like Reb Chiya, does not go like Reb Chiya. Reb Chiya says a wife, is only for beauty and to have children. So meaning, in other words, so he says, Tosfos points out, he's not saying that she shouldn't do any of the things that it says in the Mishnah. She does have to do some kind of, in particular, one of the Takonis Chachamim is Maisi Yedeho Isha Labayla, that a woman's earnings, Bederech Klal, go to her husband, and in return her husband supports her and gives her food and whatever. But so Reb Chiya agrees, Tosfos points out that, for example, she would have to spin wool or do other kinds of things like that. But we're talking about the kinds of things that we're mentioning over here, like grinding the grain and other things like that, which are pretty strenuous labor and can take away from her beauty, then Reb Chiya holds she shouldn't be required to do those things. And Einisha Labanim, and her primary purpose is to have children. We learned, by the way, in Yevamos a little while back that Reb Chiya's wife was not really so good to him. She used to harass him a lot, and nevertheless, Reb Chiya would buy her little trinkets and presents whenever he could. And he says that after all, when he's asked about that, how you talking to him, and look at the way she treats you, he says, you know, Dias shem gadlas panenu matzilos eisonu min achet. It's enough that they raise our children and that they save us from chet, because like this, a man, if he doesn't have a wife, is much more likely to be attracted to other women and whatever. So that fits very nicely with what he's saying over here. The Maharsham points out, it fits very nicely with what he's saying over here, that the purpose of having a wife is for Yofi, so that way he's not intended to be attracted to other women, and for Bonim to raise the children. V'toni Reb Chiya, also Reb Chiya taught a b'naisa, ein isha elo tachshita isha. The reason why, the purpose, what should a woman be for is for jewelry. In other words, the husband should be buying her jewelry and cosmetics and things like that to beautify her.
It's for men only.
And we could say that it's for men only. Yeah, you know, the Rambam, when he brings these halachas and hilchos issues, he says, you know, listen, there has to be a mutual thing. The wife that Amram says has to consider her husband like a sarai melech. She has to consider him like a prince or a king, or whatever he says goes. On the other hand, the husband, as we learned in Yevamos, he loves her like himself, and he honors her more than himself. So there has to be mutual respect and mutual, okay. The Toni Reb Chiya, also Reb Chiya taught a b'naisa. Haroitza she adonis ishtoi. If a man wants that his wife should be more beautiful and radiant, Yabishena klei pishtan. He should give her linen clothing to wear. Somehow, wearing linen clothing improves a person's complexion or something. And Harutz says Yabinus Bito, if he wants to make his daughter's complexion clear and that she'll look nicer, Yachilena Efroichim, he should give her little baby chicks, little baby birds to eat. V'yashkena cholov, and give her milk to drink, obviously not at the same time, Samuch l'pirka, near the time when she's coming of age, meaning Rashi says, Yemeyana Urim, the time around when she's becoming Bas Mitzvah. So that kind of diet will help her complexion and her appearance. Further, not necessarily does that apply exactly nowadays. Nowadays, we often say nishtanu ativim, that people's natures have changed since the times of the Gemara, but whatever it is, in every generation, in every time and place, there were various things that where a person's diet can have, and a person's diet and clothing and whatnot can have an effect on their appearance. All right, the Mishnah had said, one of the things a wife has to do for her husband is nurse the children. So now the Gemara goes on to discuss. Now, you have like this. Suppose the couple, Rachman al-Flan, gets divorced. Well, then she's not actually obligated to nurse the baby anymore. Then she can say, you know what, I don't want to, and you, it's your child, go hire a wet nurse for him. However, the Gemara says, if the baby already recognizes her, then you can't do that. Then she doesn't have that option anymore. Then she has to nurse the baby, because otherwise it'll be dangerous for him. So how do we know at what point do we say the baby recognizes her, and will only nurse from her? So the Gemara had brought several different opinions, but then Omar Shmuel calls Man Shmakira. So Shmuel says that it's just going to depend when he recognizes her, meaning there were other Amiroyim who offered specific numbers of days, 30 days, 50 days, whatever. Shmuel says it's not, there's no fixed amount that you can say. Every baby is different. Every baby is going to recognize his mother at a different age. So the Gemara gives an example. There was a case of a woman who came to Shmuel. She was divorced. She didn't want to nurse the baby. And the question is the baby already so attached to her that he won't nurse from anybody else? So Shmuel tells Rav Dimi bar Yosef, go examine the matter. Go do a test. So he took this woman and put her in a row of other women. So they have almost like a police lineup or something. They have a bunch of women sitting over there, and she among them. Then Rav Dimi took the baby, become a hadolei levai, when he's passing and he's walking in front of the row of women to see which one, to see if he'll recognize any of them. Keep a different gusa that somebody showing him have is that he put the baby in turn in each woman's lap. Kimotalagaba, when he came to the woman who was his mother, have a kamasvi la'apa. He's looking up, like he's gazing at her face. He recognizes her. Kavashtanu la'inamene. She turned her eyes away from him, like she didn't want that he should recognize her, because she wanted to still keep up the thing. I shouldn't have to nurse him. Give him to let my ex-husband get a wet nurse for her. But Rav Dimi tells him, Nataf Enoch, lift up your eyes, don't pretend like you don't see him. Kum Dori Brich, come pick up your son. He recognizes you and he's not going to nurse from anybody else, and therefore the din applies that you're going to have to continue nursing him until he's old enough to be weaned. The Lashon, by the way, Kum Dori Brich, is a literal Aramaic translation you have in Chumash when Hagar has thrown Yishmael under a tree over there, and then it goes far away, I shouldn't have to see him die. The Malach comes and tells her, Kumi Si'ias B'neich, Kumi Si'ias Anav Achzikias Yadich, come pick up the boy and hold on to him with your hand. This is basically a literal Aramaic translation of that. So it's like Rav Dimi is telling her, don't be like Hagar throwing away your baby, take him and take care of him. The Gemara goes on to talk about that during the time when a woman is pregnant or nursing, then she has to be careful to eat the right kinds of foods, because certain kinds of foods will have a bad effect on her milk or on her pregnancy, and others will have a good effect. So the Gemara gives a list of several things that will have a bad effect on the baby. Ein Yaakov doesn't bring them over here, but then here Ein Yaakov brings the list of good things. It brings one not so good one. Deshasya shichra, if she drinks beer during the pregnancy, have a labani uchmi, then she's going to have children who are dark complexion. The beer apparently has that kind of effect on the developing baby. Deochla bisra v'shasya chamra, if she eats meat and drinks wine, have a labani barrier, then she's going to have healthy children. If she eats eggs during the pregnancy, have a labone enoni, then she'll have children who have big eyes, which is a nice thing. Big eyes looks nicer and cuter. The Acha Kavri, if she eats fish during the pregnancy, Havala Boni Chinoni shall have children who have chen, who have a certain grace to them. Bale chen, Rashi says. The Acha Karpasa, if she eats karpas, which is parsley or some similar vegetable, Havala Boni Zivisoni shall have children who are radiant. Meaning it was like they're beautiful and like shiny faces. Yeah. The ochel kusbarta, if she eats kusbarta, which is coriander or cilantro, havel a boni bisarni, then she's going to have children who are fat. Which nowadays we might not consider that such a milo, but back then when food sometimes was scarce, then that was probably considered a milo. The ochel esroiga, if she eats esroigim during the pregnancy, havel a boni richoni, then she'll have children who are fragrant, who have a good smell to them. And the Gemara gives an example. Brata de Shabur Malka, Ochla Be'ima Esroiga. The daughter of Shabur Malka, who was one of the kings of Persia, there were actually, historically, there were three kings of that name, one in the time of Shmuel, one in the time of Rava, and another one later on in the time of Ravashi. Sometimes even the Gemara mentions a number of stories involving the first two, involving the respective Amoraim of their times, and there's even places where Shmuel, and I think in one place Rava, are called Shabur Malka, as in, like, they're the king in Torah, like the Havdil, like Shabur is the king. Is the king of Persia. So the daughter of Shabur Malka, Ochla Ba'ima Asroiga, her mother ate Asroigim when she was pregnant with her. And she was so fragrant, Rav Maskulala Kamedavu Abiresh Rechni, when they would bring in spices and good fragrances to her father, they would bring her in first at the head of them, like she smells better than any of them. Yeah.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
About the linen.
Yeah.
Was it in the old days? It was a different product, wasn't it? More kosher. Nowadays, why don't they wear linen so much?
I don't know why they don't wear linen, because they have a lot of other fibers that are available. Linen is still worn. You have it sometimes in high end blouses and things. Yeah. So there is that. But here, the Gemara was saying that's good for a woman's complexion.
Okay.
Fine. So the Gemara says, now what happens here? Meres lahonik v'huay mishaloy lahonik. What happens if there's an argument between the couple? She wants to nurse the baby, and he doesn't want. He wants instead. He figures that the nursing is going to may ruin her looks, and therefore he wants to hire a wet nurse, and she shouldn't nurse the baby. There's no question. The Gemara says, Shreiman law, we listen to her. She gets the upper hand. Saira didahu, because it's her pain. If she doesn't nurse, then her breasts are going to be engorged with milk, and it's going to be painful for her, and therefore she has the right to say, I want to nurse. What happens? Who am I lahonik? Vi hemes shaloi lahonik mahu. What if it's the other way around? He wants her to nurse the baby, and she doesn't want. She wants to hire a wet nurse. Mahu. What would be the din? Now, kol hay. Do we say? So it's like this. Kol hayka delav urcha. When it's not her usual way, in other words, when her family are rich and they can hire wet nurses, and it's not normal in her family for the women to nurse their babies, then fine, shemin law. We still listen to her because that's the kind of family she comes from, and she's entitled to still continue in the lifestyle of her family. What about he urcha v'hulav urcha mai? What would happen though if she comes from a family where they do nurse their own children, and he comes from a richer family where they don't? Mai bosa didayas linen. Do we follow him and say, well, since he comes from a family where they can afford to hire wet nurses and they regularly do, then in this case, she's saying, I don't want a nurse, so therefore that puts an obligation on him to hire a wet nurse. Or do we go according to her? Does the husband have the right to say, listen, I don't care that you don't want a nurse. All the other women in your family, all your sisters and whatnot, nurse, so you have to also. So what's the deal? So the Gemara says, so the question was asked, so we answered it based on the following. A Braisa says, Oila imei ve'eni yeredes imei. A wife goes up with her husband socially, but not downward. Meaning, in other words, that when the husband is richer than the wife, comes from a richer family than the wife, then she goes up with him. He has to support her in the style of his family. And on the other hand, if he was rich and now became poor, she doesn't have to lower her standards because of him. So that would answer the question. So we would go according to him, since he comes from a family where they hire wet nurses, then Ola Imoy, she goes up with him socially, and therefore he's obligated to hire a nurse in that case. Amar Rav Huna Mai Kros, Rav Huna says, where is the pasuk where we see this idea of Ola Imoy v'eni yeredes imoy? When Sarah is kidnapped by Avimelech, And then Hashem comes to Avimelech in a dream and tells him, you better return her because otherwise you're in trouble. And Hashem says, "V'hi be'ulas bo'al." She is be'ulas bo'al. She's married to her husband. Now, the point is, Marsha says that afterwards, a couple of psukim later, it calls her Eshes Ha'ish. So he also, when Hashem is talking to him in a dream, he should say, "V'hi Eshes Ish." Why the expression Be'ulas Bo'al? So we learn from that it has a double meaning. Ba'al Yoseh Shabal V'loi Be'yoseh Shabal. Means she goes up with her husband's status, but not down with him. So Be'ulas, in other words, redemptioning, Meloshin Be'oila, with the going up of Baal, of her husband, and not with the going down. So, Marsha explains, the background is like this. It seems that at the time that we're talking about, when they went to the land of the Plishtim, and when Sarah was kidnapped, it seems that Avraham had lost some of his wealth. Because we find, after that, that Avimelech has to compensate him with Sonu Bokov, Avodim Ushvachos, and so forth. So it seems that Avraham was not quite as rich as he had been before. So therefore, Avimelech might think to himself, you know what, listen, Hashem is telling him, you might think, fine, I understand she's a married woman, I can't keep her as a wife of mine, because that even B'nai Noyach are also in such a thing, but I'll keep her as a slave woman. After all, her husband now is poorer than he was, so no, Hashem tells him, "V'hi be'ulas bo'al." She goes up with him, but not down. Even though he's lost his nechassim, that doesn't reduce her status in the slightest, and you have to return her and make good on it.
This now is a question of status and money,
yeah.
The husband, whatever. But usually the woman knows what's best for the baby, and what she wants is that what counts?
Well, in this case, she's saying she doesn't. In this case, the question the Gemara is asking is, she's saying, "I don't want to nurse the baby," because she's saying, "I don't want to lose my looks," or whatever. Nursing is not always so easy on a woman's looks. So she's saying, "I'd rather hire a wet nurse."
More healthy for her to nurse her own baby, right?
That's usually it would be, which is why the husband is. But on the other hand, since over here, since the husband comes from a family that can afford to do that, then therefore she's entitled to say, "I demand that standard as well." And therefore, we have to do that. As we said before, if the baby already recognizes her, then that's different. Then she has to nurse him regardless, because we don't want to endanger the baby. But we're talking about the pastures where the baby doesn't yet recognize her. Maybe even they're discussing it while she's pregnant. Whatever. Yeah. Marsha doesn't say why, but it seems that Avraham yorad min chosav. The fact that we see that Avimelech, when he returned Sarah, compensated him with sonu vokov avodim ushvachos, implies that Avraham was not quite as rich as he had been before. Maybe the implication is because otherwise he wouldn't have accepted those gifts from Avimelech. I don't know. Marsha doesn't specify what makes him say that Avraham had become poorer, or whatever. But that seems to be the implication.
Of course, by Yaakov, we see that he's sending money to buy food from the shrine when there is a rov, and he goes down. He has no other choice.
So you're saying maybe the fact that Avraham went to Eretz Plishtim? I mean, here, when Avraham went to Eretz Plishtim, it was for a different reason. Rashi explains that it was after the whole thing with Sodom being destroyed, and first of all, there were fewer travelers passing through the area of Hebron, and second of all, there was the whole scandal over Lot and his daughters, and that's why he moved to the other side of Eretz Yisrael. So where Marsha...
What? He's going down to...
No, this is not when he didn't go down there because of Avraham, no.
It's the first time...
Let's say, yeah.
Let me see what...
Well,
that's what Marshall is saying. That, yeah. Okay.
Going back 1 minute, yeah. The connection between the mother and the baby is much stronger than between a wet nurse and the baby.
Okay, so...
They have a soul connection.
Nonetheless, if she says that she doesn't want to nurse the baby and the husband can afford to hire a wet nurse and the baby doesn't really recognize her or whatever, then that's what we do.
Only because
whatever it is, she doesn't want to, then we can't...
It's very selfish.
Okay, it may be very selfish, but we can't force her to yeah. Okay. Rabbi Loza Omer Mehocha. Rabbi Loza says we have a different pasuk where also we see this point that the wife goes up with the husband as far as socially and riches and whatever and not and living and standard of living and not down because the pasuk says by Chava ki he hoisa im kolchoy. She was the mother of all living. Now what do you mean all living? She's not Chava, not the mother of all living creatures, only of humanity. But we learn from that. Means that a wife is given for chayim, for a higher standard of living, and not for tsar, not that she should have to go in tsar and have to accept a lower standard of living. Marsha explains the vote is like this. Already she was called isha before, kina ish luka chazois. Then you have, there was the whole thing with the Nachash, and now she's called Chava Kihi Hoisa in Kochoi. So now, you might say, look, you know what? She caused the whole trouble. She ate from the Eitz Hadas and convinced Adam to. She caused, therefore, that she lost his status, and so therefore, maybe she should also go down in her standard of living. Note, the Pasuk says, L'chaim nitna v'lo v'tzara. To begin with, she had the higher status before the Chet Eitz Hadas, and therefore, Kihi Hoisa, she was before the Chet Eitz Hadas already. She was already in Kochoi. She was a mother who was entitled to a higher standard of living, and therefore she doesn't lose it even after the Chet Eitz Hadas. So even though, as the famous joke goes, that Adam turns to his sons and says, here, you see Gan Eden over there, that's where your mother ate us out of house and home. Nonetheless, though, we're saying that she doesn't lose her status as far as being entitled to, yeah, as far as being entitled to what Adam was giving her before, yeah. Whatever it was that he was giving her, the point is, she's still entitled to the same kind of thing after that as well. She doesn't go down.
But she bought the
Nafra. Even though she bought, even though she ate from the Eitz Hadas and all that. Yeah. Further on, the Gemara brings a couple of statements from Rabbi Yitzchak Bar Chanina in the name of Rav Huna that relates to the dinim of our Mishnah about the woman's work and the nursing and all of that. So now the Gemara, as it often does, brings another statement from him which doesn't directly have to do with what we said before. Amar Rav Yitzchak Bar Chanina, Amar Rav Huna, Hakol Mashin Bifnei Hashamash. When it comes, any food, you can wait for the, you can delay giving some to the waiter. You're supposed to give some food, a taste of the food to the waiter. But most foods, you can wait and give them afterwards after you've had the meal. Chutz mi bosav yayin, with the exception of meat and wine, because those he's going to have a tremendous taiva for, and it's going to cause him tsar, it's going to cause him pain and discomfort if he has to wait until after the meal to eat it. This is, by the way, very much Hashgacha Pratis. This is in today's Shlosh HaParakim of Rambam, that Rambam describes at the end of Hilchos Avodim, that a person, a Jewish master, is expected to be kind to, even though now technically you're allowed to work an Eved Knani with Avodis Perach and so on and so forth. Nevertheless, a Jew doesn't act that way, and he treats his Avodim Knanim with dignity and with respect. And he gives an example from this Gemara over here that the Chachamim would give their waiters and their servants from the food to taste to begin with.
It's the
Abbas of Leila Busha. Is something else as well. That's based on a Gemara in Nidya, yeah. Yeah.
It's enough.
Leila Busha. Yeah. Okay. Amar Chista, Boser Shaman V'Yayin Yoshan. So Rav Chista says we don't just mean any meat and any wine. We mean specifically fat meat and old wine. Those kinds of things are, they have a fragrance to them and therefore an aroma to them, and therefore the waiter is going to be particularly feeling bad if he can't eat from them. Omar Rava, Basar Shaman, Kol HaShana Kula, what that means is the fat meat would be any time during the year. The Yayin Yashan, but Tkufas Tamuz, the old wine, specifically during Tkufas Tamuz, specifically during the summertime, because then it's hot, and therefore the fragrance of it comes and gets into a person, Rashi says, like snake venom, and therefore he like feels a tremendous taiva for it, and if he can't have it, it's going to make him feel really, really ill. So the Gemara gives some examples. Avua ba'ihi umin yomin ba'ihi, chad sofi mikol mina umina. One of them, of these two brothers, would give his waiter or his servant or whatever, whoever's serving the meal, a little bit of each of the kind of food. V'chad sofi mechad mina, the other one would give him only from one kind. Meaning, in other words, Rashi says, not that he wouldn't give him from the other kinds, but he'd give him, to begin with, from one kind of food that's served, and then the rest he'd wait till after the meal, and then he'd give him the leftovers. The result was, Ma mishtoy Eliyahu ba'day, or Ma mishtoy Eliyahu ba'day. Eliyahu, I know if he would talk with the first one, but not the second one, because he went that extra mile to give the waiter a little bit of the food, of each kind of food, before the meal, before anybody else even has some, and for that extra bit of chesed, he was zoicha to Gili Eliyahu, that Eliyahu, I know we should talk to him.
Also, if the waiter's in a better mood, they'll take better care of
you. Probably that's true. That's a practical meaning. That's true also, probably. But yeah, what we're saying is it's a chesed on the waiter that this way he doesn't have to wait to eat it. So you see, by the way, sometimes it's the little things that make all the difference. Because here, yeah. Similarly, Hanu Tre Chassidi. Similarly, there were these two Chassidim. Va'amilor Amori v'Rapinchas B'nei Rav Chista. Some say specifically they were Amori and Rapinchas, the sons of Rav Chista. Mar Kodim Sofi Umar Ma'achar Sofi. One of them would give the waiter, if he would give him from each kind enough to fill him up. Actually, the fill him up is the previous one. Rashi says he would give the waiter first. He would have him eat some of the food ahead of time before he started serving. Umar ma'achal sofi, the other one, would give the waiter some of everything, but he would first have the waiter serve the food to him and the guests, and then he would have him take his portion. And again, the kodim sofi, the one who gave the waiter earlier, Eliyahu mishtori ba'day, then Eliyahu would talk with that one. The ma'achal sofi, the one who gave the waiter afterwards, after everybody else had been served, loy mishtoy Eliyahu ba'day, he had a little bit less of a gmilus chasadim, and therefore Eliyahu did not talk with him. What's the point about it having to do with Eliyahu talking to him or not talking to him? Marsha says like this. We know that there was a point in Eliyahu at one point is running away from Izebel. He goes, the Eibishter gives him some special food, and he walks for 40 days and nights straight until he reaches Har Chorev, and he has the vision of Hashem over there. It's in the Haftarah of Parshas Pinchas. So now, he went 40 days without eating. Meaning, in other words, that he was able to hold himself back from eating during that time. Now, the Eibishter had given him energy with that food that he ate, that he should be able to survive the 40 days, but nevertheless, it means he had to hold back his taiva to eat during that time. Well, now, when a person has a waiter over here, and he gives the waiter from each kind of food, and he gives it to him ahead of everybody else, it means, in effect, he's saying, a regular person is not able to hold themselves back with the taiva when they crave food. So that means Eliyahu. Now we see, therefore, that highlights Eliyahu. Now he did a really amazing thing by going without food for 40 days. On the other hand, if you give the waiter only later, or if you give him only from one kind earlier and the rest later, then you're showing, well, there's nothing special about what Eliyahu did. Other people can also hold back their taiva. Well, in that case, then Eliyahu is kind of resentful of that. Then in that case, you're kind of downplaying what he accomplished, and therefore he doesn't want to talk with such a person.
Easier said than done.
Yeah. So there's that. There's also Iyun Yaakov points out there's a connection together. There's a connection with a chamur that Mashiach is going to come. Oni v'roichav al chamur, and a person who feeds the waiter first shows that he recognizes that an eved is better than a chamur, and therefore he deserves to have a yo talk with him, which relates to chamur to Mashiach, and the other one not so much. Then Anaf Yosef brings another interesting idea, and it's also related to Eliyahu. We know there was a time in Eliyahu's life when he's on the run from Ahav. The Eibishter tells him there was a drought going on. Eliyahu had said there should be a drought for 3 years as a punishment for the people worshipping Avodah Zarah. He goes to the city of Tsarfas, and there's an almana over there who Hashem says is going to take care of you. She's going to feed you. So he comes, he finds she has almost no food left, but Eliyahu says, make me a little bit of food, and then you and your son will be able to eat, and the Eibishter will make a nest, and your flour and your oil won't run out. Now, the Pasuk says that they both ate from the food, but you have a kriyuk siv over there in the Pasuk. So you have the Pasuk says, v'toichal hi v'hu u'besa yomim, that he and she ate from that food for a period of time. But you have the ksiv is hu v'hi. He ate and she ate. The kri is the other way around. He v'hu. She ate and he ate. So there's a difference. In other words, basically, which one are they eating in his schus, or are they eating more in her schus? So if you say, therefore, so the one who's giving the waiter first then demonstrates that he's saying that Eliyahu maybe did the right thing, that he asked for the food first, and only then is she going to eat. Where she's serving him, therefore Eliyahu is going to speak with such a person. Therefore Eliyahu is going to speak with such a person. Whereas if you go the other way around, he ate and then she ate, like the ksiv, then it means that you're saying maybe Eliyahu didn't do the right thing, and therefore then Eliyahu doesn't want to speak with such a person. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Ogo'ola, Zayin Tevis. Chazal say, Ein Adzover Tolo El B'Tshuva, Mashiach coming depends only on Tshuva, and the Rambam brings the Jewish people will do Tshuva, or Miyad Heim Negolim. However, the Rabbah has ever talked about Nesicha, Vayichi Tavshin Nun Aleph, that for that to be fulfilled, even before that's fulfilled, that doesn't prevent the Gula Hasidah from coming. For two reasons, one of which we'll learn today, and the other tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem. The first reason is because there's not a single Yid who didn't think of Tshuva at least sometimes during his lifetime. And a Hero Tshuva can turn even a Rosh HaGomer into a tzaddik gomer, as you have the halacha. A man is makadish a woman, al-manas shani tzaddik, on condition that I'm a tzaddik, even if he's a rosh gomer, she's makudeshus, at least misafik, because he may have thought of tshuva in his heart, and if he did, then that would be enough to turn him into a tzaddik. So we see that a hero tshuva is enough, and every yid inevitably has a hero tshuva at some point. And then the other reason we'll learn tomorrow, Beis Hashem. Okay, continuing on, we started talking about the things that you're not allowed to do on Shabbos, even though they don't involve melacha per se. The pasuk says, "Min tzeichetzecha." You're not allowed to be looking after your business. So that means chafotzecha asurim. Your own business, your own needs are also, even if it doesn't involve melacha. For example, you're going to look over your business, you're going to look over your things and figure out what you need to do tomorrow, to plan for after Shabbos. So that would be also, the Alter Rebbe adds, if it's obvious that he's doing it for that reason, that he's doing it in order to make plans. Similarly, for example, let's say to walk around the city to find, let's say, a car or whatever to rent, to look and see what kinds of things are available to rent after Shabbos. If you can tell that he's doing it for that, then it would be usur. But for example, he's allowed to guard, to watch his things to prevent them from getting stolen on Shabbos or somebody else's things, that would be mutter because that's a passive thing. He's not actually going and doing anything.
Is it true that you're not supposed to think about business even in the shrutim on Shabbos?
You're not even supposed to think about business on Shabbos. That's true. I mean, that's a midas chassidus. You have the famous story in the Gemara of the guy who found a hole in his fence, etc., and he's thinking to do something about it after Shabbos. So the actual issue is not to speak about or do something about it on Shabbos. Here is mutter, but yeah, it's midas chassidus not to do that either, yeah.